Let's finish off our conversation about John Hick, and then we'll journey to India, and we'll start talking about Ramakrishna. So we're now on page 616, and where to start this? Okay, at the top of this long paragraph, which opens page 616, really what he's talking about is this issue that I sort of left off on, the difference between personal God and impersonal God. And really what I wanted to open this with, and I wish that the missing bodies were here, what I wanted to open this with was a little bit of conversation about the reaction that I got yesterday when I mentioned the idea of impersonal God and personal God, because it really seemed to me that people had no idea that there was such a thing as impersonal God, just from the reactions I was getting. Am I correct?
I didn't think of it that way, no.
You had no idea of
that?
Forrest?
I wasn't, I know, very little about Buddhism, but, from what I was aware of, that there isn't even, a God character in Buddhist religion. It's about attaining, enlightenment and a virtual space.
That's true. So you were already a little bit primed to the idea of an ultimate which is impersonal rather than personal.
Yeah.
But that was news to you. And I'm going to do it again. Jesse.
Jason.
We're going to get it. About week three, we'll figure it out. I think we'll be all right.
Okay, wait, I got to find it. I'm going to find it. I have to find a mnemonic to make this work. Okay, Jason. No. I just have to go back to my Facebook before each. Anyway, Jason. So, I mean, for you.
Me personally, especially the high school I went to in New York, it was a private school. It was a Christian-based school. I still never found a way in which a God could be personal. I've always myself personally had a feeling that, God was an almighty being or whatever the case may be, an entity. And that, I found it kind of intriguing how, especially in the school, there were always pictures of Jesus, I guess you could say, or interpretations, And it just, I never found that a way to be possible in the modern age for someone to say, okay, well, this is what it looked like.
But there was some way you could imagine some sort of divine something out there that...
Something divine out there, but, putting a face to it, was just...
That's
not
interesting.
Within me.
No. Yeah, so for you, a personal God was the challenge, whereas for you, an impersonal God is the challenge. And for Forrest, it's sort of like neither was a challenge. And I'm not going to ask Nance.
Yeah, it's both.
So Nance is a friend of mine who's sitting in on the class because she'd like to do that. And I'm glad to have her. That's all kind of interesting. And I'd ask you, but we have to do some background work first.
Sure.
Thing is, the way Hick tells this, he talks about personal and impersonal God as if personal God is sort of the Western tradition and impersonal God is sort of the Eastern tradition. That's really not true. I mean, there's a way in which it's sort of true. I mean, if you simplify everything and boil it down to, what most people think of as being religion, but that's also sort of not true even if you do that. I mean, there is a long-standing tradition in Christianity of God as being somewhat impersonal. And in Judaism, it's really a problem to figure out what's actually going on because images are forbidden. So although there's a lot of talk about God as he and personal relationship with God, there are no images of God. And the general feeling is God is sort of an impersonal person, if you can imagine what that might be. It's a little bit weird, but it's kind of the way it is. And in Islam, it's kind of hard to know, because I think some people take Allah as impersonal and some people take Allah as personal, because again, no images are permitted. And so following the kind of thing that Hick talks about, you know, it's like, where are you seated in your own mind and culture as to how you perceive reality? And so in the same religious tradition, you could be seated in the place where you see Allah in a personal way or Allah in an impersonal way. And the person literally seated right next to you might be having a totally different experience. You could be in a mosque together. And I think that that's okay in Islam. I mean, the stuff that's required has to do with the external forms. And if you go beyond the external forms, you can get over the lot if you keep your mouth shut. If you don't keep your mouth shut, to use my example of yesterday, you can get into big trouble. And that's, of course, the same these days. Okay. But if you look on the Asian side of things, and Hick suggests that the Asian side of things is more impersonal, go to India, home of impersonal religion, you see statues of gods everywhere. You see statues of gods everywhere. Has anybody ever seen any Indian dance, like Bharatanatyam dance? You have, Nancy. Anybody else has not? Okay, well, I'm not going to show you any videos, although that would be interesting to do. But if you have the opportunity to see Indian dance, most of what Indian, at least Bharatanatyam Indian dance is about miming myths, miming the stories of gods. And in the Indian point of view, if when you look at the dancer, you see the god, then that's good dance. Literally, they would say that the best dancers incarnate the divine principle being danced. So, I mean, in India, they're really big on the personal form of God, even though if you really look deeply into the philosophy, you constantly come up to this place where you look at it and you see, oh, behind all the faces of the gods, there's this impermanent, impersonal being. So, you know, I mean, Hick's distinction is interesting, but from the point of view of somebody who actually does comparative religion, unlike Hick, who's a philosopher, his philosophical arguments are good. I'm not trying to say they're not. There's a reason we're reading him, but I'm also reading him critically with you to say that there's a place where he's really seriously oversimplified things here. Forrest, yeah.
You just said that, like, the dancers, they, if they dance well, they embody the not characteristics. But
well, yeah, the characteristics and the character and the being of the divine quality they're dancing.
Isn't that, like, exactly the opposite of, like in Islam, it's like, that would be strictly not okay?
That would be strictly not okay.
But it's, like, very encouraged in Hinduism, or?
Yeah, well, so you can, yes, and you can see one of the reasons when you say that. You can see one of the reasons why the Pakistanis and the Indians don't get along on some fundamental levels.
Yeah. Well, religions.
Well, they're neighbors with atomic weapons, which is, I mean, from the point of view of being in the United States, that's actually the big problem. In my Islam course, I spent a lot of time talking about this because it is a big problem. I mean, if you pay attention to the news and what's happening in Pakistan, it's a very unstable kind of an environment. And historically, what happened there during the Cold War, when there was a Soviet Union, the United States, the Western Bloc opposed to, there were alliances that were cut, and the alliances that were cut were really interesting. So Pakistan and the United States were aligned, and India and the Soviet Union were aligned. So why did the Pakistanis have nuclear weapons? Us. We are the reason they have nuclear weapons, right? And so now we're looking at a world in the 21st century where these people do not like each other. They're constantly, the constant tension going on there. I mean, if you think about the terrorist assault in Mumbai, where they went after this hotel, these were Pakistani terrorists who were attacking Indians. I mean, this was not Al-Qaeda in the United States. It's Pakistani terrorists and Indians, right? So This is a very, very dangerous part of the world, very dangerous stuff that's going on there. And it's based in religion and culture, which is interesting. Interesting to me because in most universities, people will say, well, doing religious studies doesn't really matter. Who cares about that? We need to study physics, mathematics, and so on and so forth. Well, all those things are true, but you do need to study religious studies if you want to understand what's going on in the world. And Madeleine Albright, who is former Secretary of State, is in her memoirs says she used to come out of these meetings all the time with little notes written on her notebook saying, learn more about Islam. Learn more about Islam in order to function as a good Secretary of State. So anyhow, that's my billboard pitch for the religious studies program, which is going away in this institution. Well, it went away, but the courses are still here for a while. Okie dokie, back to the task at hand, and editorial comments aside. These non-personal conceptions of the ultimate inform modes of consciousness varying from the Advaitic experience of becoming one with the infinite, we'll talk about Ramakrishna in this respect, to the Zen experience of finding a total reality in the present concrete moment of existence in the ordinary world. Now let's skip down to the bottom of this paragraph. The evidence that a range of impersonata, which means impersonal ultimates, the evidence that a range of impersonae of the one ultimate reality are involved in the non-theistic forms of religious experience rather than the direct unmediated awareness of reality itself, consists precisely in the differences between the experiences reported within the different traditions. How is it that a direct experience of the real can take such different forms? One could, of course, at this point revert to the exclusivism or the inclusivism, whose limitations we have already noted. But the pluralist answer will be that even the most advanced form of mystical experience, as an experience undergone by an embodied consciousness whose mind-brain has been conditioned by a particular religious tradition, must be affected by the conceptual framework, this is important, the conceptual framework and spiritual training provided by that tradition, and accordingly takes these different forms. What he's saying is that your cultural form of experience, your training in spiritual life, is going to determine the characteristic of your experience of the ultimate. If you have an experience of the ultimate and you've been trained to think of the ultimate as having a face, God will have a face. If you've been trained to think of the ultimate as being impersonal, then when you experience the ultimate, it will be impersonal. It's not because God is personal or impersonal. It's because your religious tradition has predisposed you to have that experience. Because, as we talked about, culture, language, perception, we see trees in the way we see trees because of the way we see trees, because of who we are, or we see snow that way. Nance sees snow differently than me because she skis. I see snow as a pain in the neck. She sees snow as an opportunity. Okay, you do, don't you? Mm-hmm. That's what I thought. So, same snow, right? Different experience because of our predispositions. Same divine ultimate, different experience because of our predispositions. In simple language, that's all that Hick is really saying here. But he is saying something else that's important. He's saying, let me find it again. The evidence that a range of impersonae of the one ultimate reality are involved in the non-theistic forms of religious experience. I'll say, no big deal, we talked about that. But here's the important phrase. Rather than the direct, unmediated awareness of reality itself consists, and that's the key thing, consists precisely in the differences between the experiences reported within the different traditions. Hick says there's no way to have a direct, unmediated experience of God. You can only have the mediated experience, the experience mediated by your religious tradition. That's inescapable. Okay, and that's, we're going to go to India and talk about Ramakrishna on that point. And that's actually the key point, because from that derives all of this stuff about how religions and how people from one religious tradition ultimately can't know another religious tradition. they can know it superficially, but they can't have the experience of what the ultimate is about in that religious tradition. And maybe that's okay, like from Diana Eck's point of view, that's okay, because you can still have dialogue and so on and so forth. But from another point of view, understanding the nature of religions, it's not okay. Because why is it not okay? Because ultimate understanding that religious practitioners will have in regards to the religions of the rest of the world have to do with an ability to know it to be true. That's what I'm trying to say. Does that make any sense? See, intellectually we can say, here I'm following the Dalai Lama actually, in a funny way. Intellectually we could say, we know, here we're following Hick, intellectually we could say, we know that all these religions are good methodologies for achieving experience of the ultimate, because people change. They become less ego-centered and more reality-centered. That's the soteriological value that Hick was talking about. So we see that all these different religions do good things for people, so they must all be good and true religions. And that's good enough to get along with your neighbors. Dalai Lama says, that's okay, but we really need a critical analysis and a deep, critical, rational understanding of what's going on to have true faith and true, honest relations with each other. That would require, by my reading, that we don't just believe that Muslims, in their relationship with Allah, can become reality-centered, better people, but that we can experience enough of what they experience to know that what they experience is valid. Not just they look like better people, they're not throwing bombs, they're hugging each other, and they're hugging us, so they're better people. But rather, we know that their tradition is real. I mean, there are ministers in the United States who say, Islam is an evil religion. I cannot understand. What is an evil religion? What is an evil God? I can't even comprehend what that means, right? But they do believe that. I mean, they're sincere when they say this, right? So how does one deal with levels of that sense of the other as being inadequate, erroneous, or dangerous? And X says dialogue. Dalai Lama says dialogue. But I think experience is needed. It's sort of like the only way that I am going to look at snow and not see snow shovels is to start skiing. The only way I'm going to look at snow and have a positive experience is to start skiing. Otherwise, it's just going to be a pain in the neck that I have to shovel off of my sidewalk. I have to have an experience of something else which is positive. Again, to push the metaphor. Does that make sense? Yeah, does make sense? Okay. So, the last thing that Hick has to say about this, and this is kind of nice, but accordingly, this is in the last paragraph, by attending to other traditions than one's own, one may become aware of other aspects or dimensions of the real and of other possibilities of response to the real, which had not been made effectively available by one's own tradition, which he takes to be a good thing. Remember my talking about parallax vision, that the way that we know depth, what Gregory Bateson called the bonus of information that comes from having two eyes, which is depth perception. If you only have one eye, you see a flat world. If you have two eyes, they integrate the experience into something new, which is depth perception. Having two ears is nice because when sound comes from the right, it strikes my right ear before it strikes my left ear, and my brain knows, therefore, that the origin of the sound is on the right because the sound came to the right ear before the left ear. So that's the bonus of information, localization in space. The bonus of information from really knowing about multiple religions is what? A deeper understanding of your own religion, deeper understanding of the nature of religion. That's really the power of this. Okay. We good so far? Because if we are, then that's the end of Hick. Hick provides a very powerful, rational reason for religious pluralism that goes way beyond anything Diana Hick had to say. But the limitations in what Hick has to say, and that's what I want to start looking at when we look at Ramakrishna. So having said that many times, let's go ahead and do that.